Rockley, Dublino.
So this is Rockley Dublino. That's the first episode in English. So that's a new format for us, and I'm very excited to have Caroline.
Carolina.
Okay, with us. I'm gonna let her introduce herself. So.
Hi everyone, I'm Caroline. I've met Simone through TikTok, and on there I talk about interculturalism because I'm a third culture kid. As in, my parents, one was half Swiss, half Italian, and the other half Italian, half Panamanian. And I've grown up in all three of these places, going back and forth. So I speak the languages and I've lived in the places. And it's an interesting life. It's an interesting experience. And I was happy to see on TikTok that so many people could relate to this. So what I did was trying to set up a safe space for people who have this type of life experience that tend to end up as a bit invisible because we end up camouflaging ourselves in the culture we live in. So people don't see our effort behind it. And I was happy to provide this for quite a large number of people. So here we are.
Oh, that's true. Like, I found you on TikTok. Like, literally, I was just scrolling. I was like, I don't remember what was the first video I encountered of you. It was probably because I'm a lot into this topic about differences between how Americans see the world and Europeans see the world. We conceptualize life and culture very different way. So I remember probably was one of those topics. But also I started to learn more about your life, the fact that you grew up multicultural. And what does it mean to grow up multicultural? What differs you from somebody that grew up in one culture? And another question I want to ask you is it actually possible to be really multicultural, or you actually have one dominant culture inside you and the other one kind of follows?
Very good and very difficult questions. So what it means to grow up multicultural, it means that you have imposter syndrome everywhere you go. You don't ever feel 100% from a place. And I noticed this, especially linguistically, if with different languages, that sometimes the words don't just come out immediately in a single language. I always say that the more languages you speak, the worse you speak them, because, I mean, it's true. And you absolutely can grow up multicultural, in the sense that, for instance, for most of my life, I've gone back and forth, like four times a year. I would have to travel from Italy to Panama or from Panama to Italy. And it's a whole thing. It's a whole thing. You do miss out on certain things, though. That's why you always have imposter syndrome. For instance, something that made me feel very un-Italian was not sharing the whole thing of la notte prima della maturità, la notte prima degli esami. For those who don't know, in Italian, in the Italian school system, the graduating thing is the tests are insane, and it's like a traumatic event that all young Italians go through together, and it's a bonding experience because it's traumatizing. And I didn't get to have that. Also, a number of things that Italians study through high school that are inherently cultural, I had to make up for later, like learning Latin, which you think that's some weird academic bullshit. No, in regular Italian, a lot of people use Latin phrases normally, very normally. The other thing was having to read I Promessi Sposi, which made me feel very un-Italian not having read. I did read La Divina Commedia on my own beforehand, but I didn't think I should have read, and then I did I Promessi Sposi. There's a couple of things that you miss out on that you have to really understand the people from that culture that grew up in that culture. Likewise, before I even went to Panama to live, I didn't feel Panamanian, although I did have the documents. I didn't feel it because it's easy to be like, oh, I have a passport, bye. But until you speak the language, not only that, until you speak like the jargon, the dialect, the slang, until
the slangs, exactly.
The cultural context, I know there's a lot of people that like to make more grandiose their belonging to, you know, having their heritage from. But until you get there, I never truly felt Panamanian until I went to live there. And then when I did, it was a whole process to integrate, to understand, to learn the culture, to learn the language, to understand how people think. And so what does it mean to be multicultural? It means having a constant effort to remember which rules apply to which place. And by rules, I mean, how confrontational are you when you have a fight with a friend? Because Italians, for instance, are super confrontational, right? So I have a problem with a friend. I say, hey, we've clearly had a misunderstanding. Let's go have un aperitivo together and talk about it. And we may send each other to hell, which is totally normal, but at the end of it, we both get it out and we're friends again, which is fine. In Panama, you don't do that. It's very non-confrontational. And in fact, if you try to take out these issues with a friend, they'll think you're being really aggressive for no reason. And it's things that you have to remember. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, clearly. So it's not just linguistic, but it's also how you relate to other human beings. And the more cultures you have, the more of these rules you have to remember. And it's very humbling when you forget one of them and socially it doesn't go so well for you in that moment. It's a very humbling experience. And it reminds you, though, it reinforces that imposter syndrome.
I'd say language is a huge part, but it's not the main part. I think the things that happen in this society you're living in are way more important than just the linguistic part of it. The linguistic part is huge. But let's say that's a little bit of a problem that I think you have as well with Italian-Americans who claim to be Italian when they don't know what, I just say something stupid, Poste Italiane is, right? Or
the trauma.
You know, you can't relate to that. You don't know what Sanremo is. You don't know what, let's say, what's the feeling about, probably you don't know as well, but at least you try, you make an effort. But probably you don't know the feeling of coming back to middle school. I don't know how to translate that. Is a school you do between 13 years old and, no, sorry, between 11 and 14-ish, depends on what age you started. Anyway. And you come back to school and there is like The Simpsons, Dragon Ball, and Futurama, you know, on Italia Uno, which is a channel. It's like all these cultural events make you Italian when you grew up. And there is maybe references you do with one another when you talk about some things. And these are key as much as knowing the language.
Exactly.
And that's a little bit of maybe a problem we have when some other entities try to claim what we are without being through all the things we have been through as Italians, right? But I think I don't want to be rude with them. You know, Growing Up Italian, the podcast.
I was thinking about them, but you know what makes me a bit want to put I puntini sulle e, to like dot the I's and the T's.
Yeah,
is the fact that we wouldn't if they called their podcast Growing Up Italian American. But no, they called it
exactly.
Growing Up Italian.
Exactly.
That is the issue, you know?
Like, I don't mind Italian Americans. It's a new culture. It's something
it is.
Unique.
And they're interesting and they have their own subculture and that's worth respecting. The problem is that it's twofold. One, it's the fact that they call it Italian and it's not. And two, this is a symptom of American exceptionalism and thinking that they're alone in the world, as in, well, of course I mean Italian-American, but that erases entirely the existence of Italians as if they were unimportant or as if the only Italian/somethings are Italian-Americans, like completely disregarding the huge Italian-Argentinian subculture, for instance.
Half
you know?
Of the country has Italian origin, half of the Argentinians.
And they don't call themselves Italian, you know, like
they just call themselves Argentinian, even though if they speak Italian, even though maybe
True.
They grew up in an Italian household, but they grew up in Argentina. They belong to the Argentinian culture. It's the same thing if one day my child will grow up here in Dublin for some reason. and he will call himself Italian. I'll say, I'll say maybe if you're first second generation, you might still have, like you, for example, you might still have something about your native country. But when it comes to third generation and so on, let's say your child or my child, at that point is very washed out. It's difficult to bring all your culture with you forever. The Italy that the grandparent of somebody in USA right now saw a country that was totally different from the one we live in today. Probably he wasn't even speaking Italian. Probably he was speaking one of the many languages of Italy, maybe Napoletanian, maybe Ligurian, or some other languages, and probably doesn't have any.
I'm gonna have.
I
need to intervene here because I was born in Genova. Okay, although
right.
Most of my time in life I lived in Tuscany. So when you've heard me speak, you know that sometimes the Tuscan comes up. But I was born in Genova, so all my elementary was done there. And calling it Ligurian when the Genovese and the Savonese hate each other so much.
As well. There's also all these little things that whoever sees Italy from outside doesn't know about.
Doesn't know how much
Toscans hate each other. Pisa against Florence,
exactly.
Florence against Livorno, whatever. Like, these are all things that you cannot relate. That there's no way possible that your ancestor was able to bring
exactly.
you all of it.
Especially because the ancestors of the Italian Americans lived in an Italy that doesn't exist now because wasn't still unified. Therefore, through unification, Italians learned about each other, right? Because if you had asked to your great-grandfather from Calabria, okay, how people live in Bolzano, they would have had no idea. In fact, in Bolzano, they still mostly speak German.
Yeah,
because,
no,
you know,
definitely.
It's an entirely different place. So it was through the unification that academically Italians were able to learn about each other, and then through media, through television, blah, blah, where they were represented, you become painfully aware of each other's cultural differences. But it's stuff that you learn after the unification, not only of the country politically, but of the language as well.
I'll tell you more. My grandmother, she learned Italian just like when she was like 30 or something through television. She, in the daily life, she still speaks Calabrian. She only speaks Italian in special occasion, like on a birthday. She write maybe a letter in Italian and read it. Like, it's not her daily drive. Her daily drive is Calabrian. And most of all people where I'm from, most of them don't know Italian that well. They like learn it because they need it for maybe to go to the post office or maybe to go to do something, I don't know, like something like this, like post office or sending items or reading something on the internet, things like this. But most of the people, most old people in, especially in small towns, this is another big difference between Milano, Roma, these big cities and small towns. They're a little bit more isolated within the others. Probably my grandmother doesn't know about Bolzano. Probably she doesn't know Bolzano exists, I gotta say. And that's weird. It's way more complicated than people want to portray it. And also, Italians exist today? Do Italians exist today? I don't even think so that much, in a way. We're still very regional to this day.
Yes, but it's this, it's on two legs, I feel. Like, I see the same thing here in Switzerland, right? So for those of you who don't know, I'm also, as I said, Swiss, and right now I'm living in the Italian part of Switzerland. So I see it here as well. There's immense cantonal differences, even legal ones. Like, each canton has their own laws. It's a federal system, just like in the United States. But then there's this overarching Swissness that also brings you all together. So it's Italy and Switzerland have this in common, that it's a kaleidoscopic, as in you have this overarching Italianness, but then within it, there's all these different colors within it. And in Switzerland, I see the same thing. And in Switzerland, just like in Italy, the Swiss Italians are hated by both the Swiss French and the Swiss Germans. Also, they hate each other. I was talking about it with another one of my mutuals who lives in Geneva, though he's from the States. And he just sees this cultural clash between the Swiss Germans and the Swiss French that is immense, right? And we were talking about, well, you can see how Swiss Italians and the Swiss French are very much wine and cheese Europe descendant, whereas the Swiss Germans aren't. You know, so for people that are non-European or haven't lived in Europe, there's very much some lines to be drawn across from Europe. You have beer Europe and wine Europe. You have olive oil Europe
and butter.
Butter Europe, right? You have tomato Europe and potato Europe.
Definitely.
And you can see those things. And in Switzerland, you get all of them at the same time, plus the languages, plus the Romance, plus it's a mess. And yet you still have that overarching Swissness behind it, right? And I think it's the same in Italy, as in, if you look at it very close, you see they're totally different. From region to, from city to city, Italians are super different. But then if you look at it from a global point of view, yeah, you can see the Italianness.
No, definitely. I get it. It's like I think that this Italianness comes up, especially when you go abroad. But yes. I think that applies to many cultures. Like when we are in Italy, we're like, I'm Calabrian, you're Tuscan, we're walls apart. As soon as we're outside and somebody says, oh, you know, I don't actually like pizza that much. Yeah. Oh, I'm Italian. Maybe pizza is not even from your region. Polenta is not. I don't eat polenta that much. Where I'm from,
removed from your culture.
Exactly. Like, but if somebody says, "Oh, you know, polenta is shit," like, nah, you don't touch polenta, okay? So it's like when we're outside, we bring all these cultures together and we wear them, you know. And I think it's the same in a larger scale within Europeans and Americans. You know, we're continents, right? But when we are talking to an American, we bring out our Europeanness as well. You know, say, oh, we conceptualize things different in Europe compared to America, and etc. We need to make some generalization to do so, of course. But we bring out that thing as well. So I always say the day that all humans will come together is when the aliens come around and be like, oh, you know, that human thing you do, we don't like that much, you know? And we were like,
oh. Oh, dare you. It's true. You know, what I think that there is, I try to think a lot about why we have such huge differences with the United States. And I think that the one true thing that really separates the US from Europe when we talk about social issues, I've come to realize is the fact that they have, like, the people in power now in the US, because clearly I'm not talking about the Native Americans who to this day are victims. In the US, they have never been a victim of anything. Like, the people in power in the US,
they need a Mussolini. They need Mussolini. You know what I mean? They need. No, but you get what I mean. You get what I mean.
I know what you mean. Like, I wouldn't have phrased
social wise in Italy, we know what dictatorship is.
Exactly.
We know what how freedom of speech is important, etc.
You know what it's like to go around and see, like, your monuments with bullet holes in them. You know what it's like to see what your grandpa, where your grandparents' house was, and it's longer there because it was bombed. We have tales. Grandparents of, like, them hiding the partisans in their country houses or weapons for them, or, like, we have tales of how our grandparents would have to, like, one of my friends showed me at her house, her family house, like, oh, this window gave my grandparents the access to the roofs where they would walk around the city to go to their friend's house to get a bag of flour because it was too risky to go in the streets. They don't have this, right? And you can see this by the fact that the biggest thing that happened to them was 9/11. That if we very coldly, cold-heartedly go and look at the number of deaths from 9/11, it's very little compared to a lot of the conflicts that, like,
it's like probably during the Anni di Piombo in Italy, like, this was every couple of weeks there was some bomb in Bologna train station. Just to say some, you know, it was like the 9/11 for them was our World War II.
Exactly.
In a way.
And so you can see by the fact that that was extremely shocking for them. And if you look at the amount of deaths, it's like, I mean, if only they knew what it was like in Yemen, they would be like, okay, nonplussed. However, if you look at their World War II, the biggest hit that they had was Pearl Harbor, which was in fact a military base and not a civilian place, you know, not their city, not where families lived, right?
Definitely,
and B,
yeah.
It was occupied territory because it was still Kingdom of Hawaii. So it wasn't even like home. And how did they reply? Two fucking atomic bombs.
Yeah, it's like that tells you how safe your country is, how lucky you are, and
exactly.
how you have no idea what the world out there is.
Exactly. And
not
so
just now, but in historic wise, you know, the way your history evolved. Let's say after the, you know, there was the war of unification, the north against the south. Okay, that happened, but historic wise, that was your only war. Civil War.
That's a civil war. And when was that? It was centuries ago. Centuries, you know?
Definitely. I think more than 2.5 for sure. I think it was around the 1800s.
Right. So
18th century, sorry.
How much? And considering how they rebuilt buildings, like they hardly have historical buildings, how much of an impact on your architecture and daily lives do you have from that, you know? So it's not really seeable. Whereas here, you know, a lot of like families lost their entire fortunes, and due to this day, right, there is an immediate impact. But more than anything, culturally, I've realized that you know, the beauty of Italy is that its culture came already from a melange, a mix of cultures due to either trade or invasion. So Italians culturally know what it's like to have another culture imposed onto them. You know, on TikTok, I made the example of like espresso. Espresso coffee is one of the most iconic Italian food items. How did we have that? Well, because due to the, so coffee is a Yemenite invention. And from the Ottoman invasion, they just sent Italians like their shittiest coffee beans. So Italians would have to over roast them to not get sick from them. And that's how you have your rich, super dense espresso. It came out of poverty. It came out of necessity. It came out of oppression. You know, Nutella, same thing. There was a cacao shortage. And so they were like, fuck it, let's just use hazelnuts because we don't have it. It came out of necessity. It came out of poverty.
Even some of the Roman dishes, like the carbonara, was during the World War II. You know, they took the dried eggs from the American military and bacon, and they made the dish. Now we made it. You know, the modern recipe is a little bit different, but that's the origin. But a lot of dishes, for example, in my region, came out. Probably a lot of people out there don't know. Like probably you know the nduja, maybe.
And you know, that is something that you should reply to the Americans when they say, oh, you know, because white people never eat spicy. Amore di zia, have you tried nduja? It's a slap in the face, honestly. So
no, but most of our food is very spicy in Calabria anyway. Now the thing was, like, the nduja and all the other meats we eat is usually from how to explain this, every year in January. So basically, we grew up an animal, a pork. Every year in January, my grandmother, when she sees the moon at the right point, I don't know what does it mean, she just come out and says, you know, today the moon is good. We're going to kill the pork, right? So we make everything. We use every single part of the animal, because back in the day, we didn't have, we couldn't waste it. You couldn't afford to waste any part of the animal. And I'm saying blood. And I'm saying we make the sanguinaccio, which is we mix blood and chocolate, and we make this bloody chocolate, which is actually pretty nice. Or nduja as well is one of those process. And you know where we had all those spices, because the meat was not great, so you need to cover the flavor as well.
And also, spice is an antibacterial. It's for the preserve, right? So the same goes with the salt, like salting and smoking the sausages, blah, blah. It's so that most bacteria cannot survive through that. It it dehydrates the meat. And so that's antibacterial.
Yeah, all over dry cuts, yeah, come from
that. So the one that I've had is from Emilia Romagna.
What was that?
Do you make testata as well, where you boil the head and then you make?
Yeah, we boiled everything though. We do. It's called caldara. We boil the livers, the brain, the heart, everything. You know, everything you wouldn't eat as it is. You make this big broth, and there is a night, and we put also bones with a little bit of meat in it. Because the kids don't actually eat like the livers as well. Like it's not like in the good old days. Now the kids are a little bit more, you know.
Yeah.
So we also put some bones with a little bit of meat, so the kids eat the meat, and we don't waste anything. And that comes some of our best dishes and our beautiful traditions, because you couldn't afford to waste, because there was a poor region. Calabria is probably the poorest region in Italy, I think. I'm pretty sure about this. Yeah, I don't think so. There's anything else. I was working in.
I'm trying to think, but probably correct.
Probably correct. I'm telling you, I was working in Italy, and I was working for €2.50 per hour. So I'm pretty confident saying that. So.
No, you know, my favorite dish from Genova, right? Because a lot of places have poor dishes that become the most iconic dishes. My favorite dish from Genova is panzotti al sugo di noci. And panzotti are stuffed type of pasta that are made with a type of cheese curd that is made in Genova, and with a mix of herbs that you can only find. Like, those herbs are kind of widespread, but that all those put together, you can only find them in the mountains behind Genova. So they used to go and scavenge these ingredients, and they're like, you know, weeds and bitter herbs and shit that you would find like on the mountain floor of the forest. And they made like my favorite dish out of it, but it's because that's what they could find and there was nothing else. There weren't high quality ingredients. And I think that the beauty of culture, whichever country it's from, is like long-standing culture, like millenary culture, is that they make out of necessity, out of the lack of things, they make beautiful things, which I think is great. Like the fact that, for example, in Japan, their most iconic dish is sushi, right? But the reason why they're so big on fish is because they do not have the farmland to grow other farm animals. And so out of necessity, they became expert in fish cuisine. So I think that's the cool thing about culture.
That's because you just mentioned, I'm curious about Japan. You said you lived in Japan?
Very few months.
Okay.
I lived in Tokyo, for those who know, in Shinjuku Sanshome. I love the neighborhood. My Japanese, don't look at me like that. My Japanese gets the job done, but it's not good.
It's Japanese, like, you know, I just know konnichiwa, arigato, and that's it.
Pretty good enough. You know, an American would say that they speak Japanese if once they knew how to say those two things. So.
I'm fluent. That's the reality. I'm fluent in anime.
In anime, you're fluent in anime. That, you know, that's one of the funniest things. If you learn Japanese through anime, first of all, they're gonna, like, it's embarrassing to be pointed out as an otaku in Japan. They think it's really creepy. It's cringy, more than creepy.
Okay.
But they don't speak like that. They don't, because it's exaggerated, clearly, right? And so if you try to speak in Japan the way they speak in anime, they're going to look at you like you're fucking insane.
Yeah, I can imagine, like, with all that eye tone voice.
Exactly. Exactly as if somebody came to Italy and started speaking, mamma mia, che buona la pizza, blah, blah.
Exactly, that's what I was thinking about. Like, you know, people thinking that we speak English like that. I mean, I don't. I know some people who speak very macaronian English.
Macaronian
English, actually. You know, like, no offense to my brother, but he has a very Italian way of speaking in English. You can tell from the distance that is Italian. Well, with me, I think I do have a little bit of an accent, but not as much. The other days, I was talking with an Irish guy, Hirsch Fala, and he was telling me that I lived in Dublin since 2018. He was like, you have an American accent. I was like, nah.
Yeah.
Tell me that.
So my childhood friend, I think it's hysterical, also the name, because I'm Carolina, she's Guindalina. Fucking hilarious. when I went to live in the United States, because I did my middle school in California, she went to live in Dublin, in fact. Right?
Stop there. Can you just tell me your... I want to know where you... Because you lived now in the United States. I want to know that now. So
I was born in Genova, and for middle school, and I went to elementary school there. Then we moved to California. That's where I did my middle school. And for high school, we went to Panama. And once my high school is done, I went back to Italy for university, where I went in Tuscany, Pisa. And from there on, I stayed a bit back and forth from Milano and Pisa. So I stayed a lot in Milano. And then during
just
that
one question.
Time,
after university, what you did job wise?
So university, I studied physics.
Okay.
Right. So job wise, I got into the family business. My father is I don't want to say it because I don't want to be traceable, but it was an inventor. So we have patents, okay? And our main clients were Japanese. Okay. So he was also a physicist, by the way. So with my parents are separated, with my family business is where I continued, and now to this day I still do physics applied to finance.
Okay, that's cool as hell. Like physics, I used to love science in middle school. The thing was, if you don't have a good teacher, you know, like everything crumbles down. So I used to love science. I used to read the entire school book, like just for fun. I used to love it. But my teacher, I think, never pushed me to learn it as much. So kind of fell off. It was actually my dream when I was as a kid. I wanted to be, I was obsessed with space. So
yeah, I wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to be an astronaut. So,
not an
yeah.
astronaut. I wanted to be an engineer in the field of
aerospace.
Or just actually study even theory. That tickles me. So I'm listening a lot of Neil deGrasse Tyson. So yeah, I have his book here somewhere. Amazing book as well.
I think that to be a physicist, though, you have to be a special kind of weird. As in, I noticed with my course colleagues that we were all very weird in the same type of way. Because you need to be able to visualize certain very abstract concepts in your head. And you know how they say that? So people have like an inner monologue. They ask me, so here it is. One of the questions that I'm asked most often is, in what language do you think? Right? And I replied that I actually think in shapes. I don't think in language. And that was something that I had in common with most of my fellow classmates in physics. Ah, yes.
How do I think? Now your question, like you're making me question, how do I think? I think in languages. I think discourses.
Most people think in languages. Most people do. So I think that the reason why I liked also science and physics so much was because language wasn't an issue. As in, we use math as a language, and math is a universal language.
It's universal language, certainly, exactly.
For me, the fact that there were no cultural rules in physics and in mathematics, it just was, and it was universal. For me, it was something that, you know, gave me a lot of mental peace.
Okay, so you think there is, I mean, I know there aren't theoretically, but like cultural biases do apply also in science, no?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Not in mathematics, though. As in, you can have different approaches to the same type of calculation.
Okay.
But don't make it non-understandable.
You can't have different results anyway. Like you might have different approaches. Yeah.
You have a different path, but if you have a different result, then something is wrong. You know,
I was thinking social sciences are a little bit different, but like psychology, sociology, you might have a lot of biases applied there.
Because you have human error. Whereas, yeah. So physics, because they asked me, like, how the fuck do you apply physics to something like finance and economics? And I explained that physics is the science of everything that is measurable. So the idea is anything that can have a number applied to it, making it a measure, a physical measure, which includes, of course, money because it's numbers and it's measurable. It's a measurable quantity. The idea is that you observe a phenomenon and you try to find a function that describes that phenomenon. And once you have it, it needs to be able to be replicated anywhere else in the world. Basically, once you create this function, it should allow you to see the future. As in, if I throw a ball and I drop it from this height with the same constants of altitude, with the same constants of whatever, everywhere in the world, the ball should fall with the same timing because gravity at the same altitude is equal, you know? And it shows that
if
I
you
can
think,
tell
I
want
to
see.
Yeah. I was thinking. Go ahead. I thought you were stopping here. Yeah.
The same thing with everything that is measurable, essentially. The problem with finance and economics is that it's connected to social sciences, which include human error and freedom of thinking, right? However, when you applied probability in calculation, then you can have a sigma that is small enough for you to be able to do risk management. You take into account human error and you use statistics to do that.
All right, now
like,
because I was
calculation, not statistics, like polls, like statistical calculations, like probabilities.
Probabilities, yeah. Now, I was thinking, if I think about finance, the first science that will come in mind to me will be actually most of the social sciences, because finance are affected by social events.
By human choices.
Yeah, that's what it was. A little bit counterintuitive to think about physics involved in finance. I will rather, like, it wouldn't surprise me if you say, listen, I'm a sociologist that works in finance. That would be like, it's easily understandable.
Let me give you an example. How do you think you can calculate the way in which single molecules of gas travel in a small box filled with different gases? It's called entropic calculations. So it's chaos theory. And you can actually calculate that type of things. In fact, there's a lot of very interesting phenomena in physics that have to do with, these are called fluid dynamics, whether it's gas or liquids, it's called fluid dynamics. And it includes a lot of chaos theory and chaos calculations. And you can 100% fit a function to the chaotic choices that single households make within an economy into what they choose to buy.
That's wild.
So, yeah.
It's way more complicated than it seems like.
But I'll be honest, 80% of the time, what I do is just a glorified accountant. 80% of the time. Sometimes
it's always like
I do this. Yeah. So it's kind of like when they tell you all in school, you're going to need calculus and whatever. And then instead, what you end up doing is just using Microsoft Excel most of the time, right?
It's always like that. Like, I'm studying international security and conflict studies. Okay. It sounds cool. I will just end up doing reports about whatever happening in Ukraine. You know what I mean? Like, it's not that, it usually is way less funny than it seems when you explain. That thing applies to a lot of job descriptions. I was actually thinking, now that you brought the science part in it, what's your position taking account of entropy?
Yes.
In environmentalism?
This is a big one. So, because there's a science part and there's a finance part and there's a social part to this. This is really complicated. Let me give you an example, okay? Financially speaking. So I get asked very often, what do you suggest I invest in, right? And I think that the most linked to to the environment is, of course, raw commodities, right? And I would have to say right now, like, if I had to invest in any raw commodity directly, just thinking about the monetary part of it, it would be cobalt, right? Because you need cobalt to make any lithium ion battery, you know, for the batteries. It's mostly silicon based, okay?
But, you know, I was thinking, you know why? I have this position that is like, you need, if you are an actual environmentalist for human reasons, because you care about humans, you must be also interested, and you need to support space exploration. I know these two things don't often don't
seem to match, but yes.
In the way I see it, and I think a lot in way some people.
So let me get to that, and I will in a second explain to you why that's difficult to apply and why people don't follow that line of thinking. So right now I was talking about Cobalt, right? Why do I not invest in Cobalt? I don't feel it's morally correct, because the stabilization of those prices and keeping them low depends on the destabilization of the Congolese government. So there's other governments that keep the Congolese government unstable so that the prices of cobalt are low. And you can see how that's like ethically wrong, okay? The same goes for a lot of other raw commodities, not to that extent, but it's happening. And so that's why I morally refuse to invest in certain things, although financially, it would be the best decision right now, right? So the problem with finance is that it uses a lot of exploitation. And that's why people that work in finance are known to be like sharks and whatever, because they exploit. So I refuse to do that. I believe in ethical investments, right? Which means there's less gain, but I also live better with myself at night. So I get to sleep. I think they also sleep well, but that's because they're sociopaths. That's another matter entirely. Instead, when I think about it in a global point of view, in a social point of view, with environmentalism, the problem again is that anything that has to do with people, it's strictly correlated with their economic needs, right? So the biggest issue right now, for instance, you mentioned Ukraine, is actually the fact that there's going to be a flour shortage, and the shortage is going to impact mostly poorer countries, right? And so, you know,
developing countries now.
Developing countries. So, you know, this wouldn't be an issue if we were able to grow better crops elsewhere, but you need investments. So it's because of the misdistribution of resources, as usual, right? And that's why it gets to a point where you're saying, let's invest in space exploration. Now, let me explain to you why a physicist will never make as much money as an engineer. Okay, never. And that's because anything that is not immediately marketable is not worth investing in from private companies. So any physicist, the reason why I went into finance and not into physics, aside from it being extremely competitive as a STEM environment, it's also because you rely on government-funded research. Because private companies will not invest in physics research that may or may not have an applicability, maybe in 20 years. Physics is so far ahead from the market that you cannot have a return on investment in your lifetime if you invest in that. So either you do it out of philanthropic inclination, or it's not financially viable to do that, right? So instead, with engineering, you finance studies that give you a product eventually, which will give you a return on investment. And that is the same reason why people will not see the resolution of the environmental issues in space exploration. They will not follow that line of thought, although it is abstractly correct. It's non-feasible, because by the time that we find resources elsewhere and we find something that is economically viable as a system of transportation back and forth in order to exploit those resources, then we have no return on investment. You see what I mean?
Economic-wise, I totally see it. But I also spoken with some environmentalists, even on this very podcast. And oftentimes the idea of space exploration, and it seems that what I feel like people think that the cost in terms of environment impact of space exploration, in terms of, like, let's say thinking just about rockets, or, you know, is not worth what you might or you might not find. But it's not only about this. It's like, how long in the future do you care about humanity? Because a lot of environmentalists, I think they only care about their children. So in 50 years from now, but let's think in 500, 600 years, we all know that entropy exists. We know that the sun is gonna raise its temperature no matter what we do. no matter what we do, the sun will go hotter and hotter generation after generations. We can slow down the process that of raising temperature in this world, but we cannot stop it. So at a certain point, if we actually care about humanity, we need to find solutions in the very long term to move away.
That's the point. I think that the more I travel, the more I live around the world, the more heartbreaking thing I found is that people are inherently selfish.
I do agree.
And so when selfish, do you agree or do you disagree?
I do agree so much. People love to look like and they care about others, but they don't.
And that's right. It's facade. It's publicity. It's commercial. It's whatever. It makes them look so that general approval. But inherently, people are selfish. And to you know, spezzare una lancia, to be honest, I can't blame people that perhaps aren't just dripping with money, right? To Absolutely. Not want to care about 500 years.
But be real, just say it. That,
right? Exactly.
Yeah, walk the
but
talk.
However, we have a number of people that are your Elon Musks, your Jeff Bezoses, that could have the luxury of doing that, but they don't. So that's what breaks my heart. You know, you could. I mean, you know, when I saw Jeff Bezos' interview when they did the first civilian flight, space tourism. Virgin, Amazon, and SpaceX are all like in this race about the space tourism, right?
Yeah.
Seeing Jeff Bezos in that fucking cowboy hat, being excited as a little kid during Christmas, right? On Christmas morning, about his little flight and not understanding how much that was a waste of money compared to what the world needs. For me, it was heartbreaking.
I have to say, I'm very aligned with the activities that actually SpaceX is doing for the most part, collaborating with NASA on the new Artemis project. Actually, I wrote my independent study project on Artemis. I don't know if you know the Artemis project.
No, I do not.
So basically, the Artemis project is a NASA-led project, which is actually involves most of the space groups around the world, even the European and the Italian, by the way, and Japanese as well. So basically, the goal is to come back to the moon and establish a colony there in the next 5 years. Actually, it's not even that far away. They did the first trip without people around the moon and come back. In next year, they're supposed to do one with people around the moon and come back without landing. And in 4 years, they're supposed to land and start a colony. So I was writing about the political implication of it, but that's another story. And okay. SpaceX is involved in this project. And I think they're moving in the right direction. I think there is a little bit of a push towards what we're saying, like moving towards with humanity. There is also a very big economic part in it. I'm sure about it. Nobody's perfect. It wants money as well. But I see it a little bit of perspective in what he's doing. What do you think? Like, I think that this is a topic that came up very often in your videos, and it's how we differ from the Northern Americans in conceptualizing race, ethnicity, and, you know, the way we view other people in general. So what do you think is the main differences between Europeans and Americans in conceptualizing those things?
So I think it's really important when we have to fight racism, because I mean, that's the end game, right? To understand where it comes from, right? And I think that in the United States and in especially Mediterranean Europe, it comes from two diametrically opposed sources, as in, well, first of all, there's the fact that up until very recently, historically, in the US, they had segregation and they still feel the implications of that, right? And yep. You see that because mixed people are a thing but it's not, it's there's still a lot of socioeconomic gates between them, and you can see they're treated generally, right? What they don't seem to understand is that the concept of, first of all, of race being directly correlated with skin color is something that in Italy doesn't quite apply, because once you've mixed for millennia with North Africans, you have a gradient. And so,
fun fact, my surname is Arabic, is Raskella, which comes from Rizkala, because Calabria was for about 100 years under the Aghlabid dynasty, which is a Northern African dynasty. So we've been conquered by the Arabs. And, you know, it's way more complicated than people want to portray.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they don't understand that in some towns in Sicily, the staple local food is couscous. They don't get that. And in fact, I'm not a fan of Sicilian sweets, although they're, you know, cannoli, cassata siciliana, those things, because it's very dry. I'm a, you know, a spongy, cakey, custardy type of sweet person.
You like baba?
No, because that is also like kind of like I need more dairy in my sweets.
Okay,
where coming through. But instead, if you look at them, they're much closer to like a baklava, you know, a Sicilian sweets, than they are to the cake, you know,
maybe puddings or
exactly. So, and you can totally see that from the cuisine. But yeah, so whereas in the United States, you can clearly pinpoint, I found some of the most bizarre articles online, be like, ooh, actors that you didn't know were actually not white. And you look at them and they totally look white, but they have like maybe one African ancestor and suddenly they're not white. And that makes no sense by Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, Greek standards, because we've been mingling for literal millennia, and so there's a gradient.
A story about this.
Please do.
So basically what happened the other day, I was talking with one of my Irish friends, and it was like, oh, you know, Ireland was the oldest colony in the world. It started in the 12th century. I was like, are you sure about that, my boy? Because Calabria was colonized... It was a boy. Calabria was colonized the first time by the Greeks back in the 8th century before Christ. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about millennia, like 2,000 plus years ago. And this concept is mind-blowing. And like to tell you, like you said, millennium is actually millennia.
It is.
Thousands of years of
colonization. It is millennia, literal millennia. Also, back and forth, Sicily has been nearly 500 years Arabic between all the different conquests back and forth. Like, Sicily has been longer Arabic than it has been Roman.
That has been Italian, if you think also about it.
Well, yes, but I mean, Roman, you know? So, it's insane. And they don't understand that. So, there's you can't pinpoint, and you also can't have proud ancestry because it's so mixed.
So many, actually. Like, I was thinking, like, if we talk about Calabrians, we're Spanish, French, Arabs, Byzantine for hundreds of years, Greeks, Normans, like it's so much, so many that at a certain point we actually we don't see as, we actually take them as part of our history rather than hating them in a way.
Exactly. Like, let me tell you one of the weirdest things that I've been told by a person from the US, right? So I was saying how a part of my family descends directly from when the Spanish invaded southern Italy, right? So the part from Naples, Rome, Naples, blah, blah, blah. That part of my family.
I Borbone.
No, Yaragona.
Yeah, Yaragona.
Were then conquered in kind by the Borboni, right? So that part of my Spanish heritage is the Aragonese that came and invaded Italy, and then they make I quartieri spagnoli, like the Spanish ghetto inside of Naples, right? And then when they were conquered back, they got left behind. And I got called a colonizer. And I'm like, you do understand the ones that were like left behind and then colonized back from. There has been. So when we talk about colonialism, something that people in the US don't understand because they don't have a full grasp of history sometimes, because they don't teach it in schools, very simply, because they don't care, right?
And you studied there, so yeah. you can tell me.
They bumped me up 2 years in math and science. 2 years. And I didn't speak the language when I got there. So you can just imagine, like, I barely spoke English when I got there. So you can just imagine how it was. And I was shocked. And everything in history class was just US history. And maybe it's just because what they did in middle school, but in other like years they would do. Like, I remember my first year of middle school, we were studying about like different cultures. And what they made us do as class projects was just, dude, I remember this as if it was yesterday, which is weird. So we were talking about Arabic cultures, right? So Northern Africa to Middle Eastern cultures. And they were like, okay, so what you are going to do, so they gave us like different little things to do to talk about these cultures, was they gave me, so you have dictionary type of things. So these are common terms used that we still use today, sometimes from like Arabic culture, and you need to put what they mean. So do this like dictionary type of situation. And what I did, because I'm an absolute fucking nerd, was that I took a box and I made a sapientino. I don't know how you call it in English, but like I use aluminum foil.
I don't know if there is a translation for sapientino, honestly.
Make the connection. But so you would connect the two correct ones and it would light up a tiny like, right?
It's like a game with the version I had was like with a pen.
Yeah, exactly.
You had to press the right answer and will beep.
Right answer. Yeah. So with mine, you had two ends, which would close the circuit basically. And you would have to put it in the two right words and it would close the circuit and light up the light, right? And I had to do that because I thought that like culturally and historically speaking, the assignment was so easy that I had to make it fun for myself somehow, and I had to make up a whole fucking machine to do it because it was so stupid, you know, in my head. Like, these are just terms and their translations. This is the ABC, especially from somebody that already spoke multiple languages. I was like, this is too easy. This is not. So whatever. Anyway, their conceptualization of history is, I think the best way to see it, it's going to sound hateful. It's not. But you can see it. They call medieval anything that spans from the actual Dark Ages up until like the 1800s. If you look online for like a Victorian costume, you will find the tag #medieval.
Victorian. The medieval, like I think classical studies said the medieval ended at the fall of Constantinople, right?
Exactly.
And the discovery of America as well, 1492.
Exactly. So, like, they don't have a true concept of history because it's so far removed from not only what they teach, but you don't see it in your everyday life. Here you do. Here you have, like, in Foro Romano, if you go to Rome, here you have, like, Etruscan tombs. You see them, like, you see them. And so you can see, like, the architectural differences and history is here. You live through it every day. It's hard to miss, you know? So there, they have this weird concept. And what they don't understand when it comes to colonialism is that the big bad white person that colonized, they're just the latest assholes.
The latest, exactly.
In a cycle of back and forth colonization.
You know what baffles me? There is slavery today, 2023, mm-hmm. in Mauritania. It became decriminalized 2017. We're talking 5 years ago.
Jesus.
You know, in Mauritania, look it up. There is a lot of documentaries about the situation of slavery in Mauritania. I'm not talking about modern slavery like child labor, yeah. This kind of thing. We're talking about masters.
Yeah, and slaves.
Enslaved, like the way you would imagine in USA during the slave trade. It's today, it's 2023, it still exists, it's real, and nobody cares about what is happening in Mauritania. Nobody talks about it on internet. Nobody talks about the slave trade from East Europe of sexual slaves. into the West and America. Like nobody talks about this actual real topic. They spend time about fighting about things up in 3 years, 300 years ago, 200 years ago.
One of my favorite comedians, Eddie Izzard. Did you know Eddie Izzard? He's one of my favorite comedians, and he said he made a sketch saying, you know, they don't talk about Pol Pot, they don't talk about, you know, Russia, whatever, because they killed their own people. The reason why Hitler though became like the icon of genocidal evil is because he kills somebody else, people next door. So the chance to only villainize those who kill people who are not their own, but in fact there are also a lot of more genocidal maniacs around that are just as bad.
You just added one more layer. Jewish were white, so this idea of the white bad, you know, Jewish were white. Jehovah's Witness. My mom is Jehovah's Witness, right? Jehovah's Witness were in the concentration camps. My mom is white, you know, and he's an American religion as well, just to say it. And it's like all these layers. It's way more complicated than the
so much more complicated
victim.
I did two TikToks where I asked, "What is considered in the U.S. a white person?" And they replied en masse. They replied, "A person who is not a person of color." And then I asked, "What is a person of color?" And they said, "Anybody who's not a white person." I'm like, bitches, you do realize this is...
It's nonsensical.
It's Lapalissian. It's tautological. It makes no logical sense. And especially this doesn't apply, especially in cultures where people have mixed for millennia again, you know? So first of all, we need to see like where the racism comes from, right? So historically in the US, you already have like, you had... When you start a slave trade... You have to use something, anything, to allow you to dehumanize that group of people in the eyes of those who you need to buy them, right? Because if you humanize them, then people are like, no, these are, you know, they're just like me. So the slave trade ends right then and there, you know? So by doing this, by dehumanizing them, you make it economically viable, which is horrid, right? So that persisted well into slavery and well into segregation, that mentality. But as you said, right, because especially because, you know, Jews are white, it's a total social construct that by defining what is white and what is non-white, which is again something that is nonsensical, you dehumanize people. You make them, nowadays it's more like a class A person, class B person type of thing, but they're both nonsense. They are both nonsense, right? Also, the one thing that I think sends people from the US into hysterics is when I tell them the most racist people that I have ever met are the Japanese. The most
racist. I hear that so much. Men. I hear that. Indian as well. I hear that a lot about, you know, there is the caste system inside of India.
Yes, exactly. In Sri Lanka, this is also true, but they will not wrap their brain around them because in their country, those are the people that are ostracized.
These are minorities, right?
Exactly.
And
so
American exceptionalism as well, again, in this context
in this
as well.
So this is why, although I wanted to talk only about multiculturalism on TikTok, I oftentimes find myself having to fight this US rhetoric because it kills the viewpoint of so many other places in the world where it's just legitimate. And on top of it, if you try to superimpose the dynamics through which racism exists today in the US onto another country, which might be France or Spain or Italy or Greece, you will never fix the racism problem because they have two different natures. So first of all, Black people, African Americans, right, in the US, were brought there against their will. Historically, they were brought there against their will. They erased their heritage. Okay, do you know the history about the country of Liberia, which I think is so inhumane?
That's why Liberia was the only country not colonized. Actually, they were involved in the slave trade.
Exactly, exactly. But no, I mean, like Liberia was the reverse colonization type of thing, as in not knowing where they got their slaves from once slavery was abolished in the US, since they did such a good job dehumanizing them, didn't want to live with them anymore. Also, maybe because out of shame, rightfully so, but also because they didn't know how to fix it socially. So they created an entire fucking country, Liberia, Liberty, in Africa, to put back all of their slaves because they didn't know whether to bring them back to Nigeria or the Congo or whatever, because they didn't know, because they erased their history, you know? And that is truly inhumane, and it goes to show. But those were people brought against their will into the United States. When it comes to other countries, especially those that are in proximity to Africa, if you have African immigrants, they are coming surely out of necessity, perhaps out of desperation, but they are going there
willingly. They want to go there. They want to reach Lampedusa. They want to reach whatever.
Exactly. So in the US, when you have cases of racism against Black people, it's, I think, out of shame, out of the need of dehumanize them in order to excuse their atrocious behavior during the slave trade, right? Whereas I think that in places like Italy or Spain, this does not excuse racism. This does not excuse it. It doesn't make it any better. It doesn't make it any better. But I think it's born out of fear, out of having been previously colonized by Northern Africans, out of history and out of the necessity to preserve
culture as well. Yeah, that's what an argument you hear from sometimes from very far right people as well. But
exactly,
okay,
exactly,
it's like
exactly.
These people, they want to eradicate my culture,
exactly,
my Italianness.
In fact, they do not.
I worked with asylum seekers in Caritas when I was in high school as well. These people are like, some of them, they've been through hell. They just want a better life. They're willing to become Italian,
exactly,
in a way.
In fact, they work so hard to integrate, to learn the language, to know the culture, to do that. They work so hard to do that. And so, again, it's out of ignorance, right, that extremely racist Italians sometimes become racist because they are afraid of something that they do not know. They're afraid of something that they feel is foreign, and it's easy to classify as foreign a person that doesn't look exactly like you. But it's like the stupid man's shortcut into putting walls between us, right? When in fact, a lot of Italian culture is directly born out of the influence from North Africa.
But the thing is, the Italian is as racist as with, let's say a racist Italian is as racist with the African as it is with the Chinese,
mm-hmm,
as it is with the Terrone. I don't know.
With a Terrone with yours.
No, that's not a joke. That's not a joke.
I try to tell people from the US, look, I don't think even the most racist Italian will ever treat a Black person as badly as they treat a Romani.
Oh, definitely as well. Definitely as well.
And they're like, no, that's not true, because no, you're seeing this through your own lens where you had segregation.
Oh, it's true. It's true.
And honestly, I've seen dark humor memes about this. The fact that in a lot of times, everybody, like a lot of Italians, are non-racist up until the Romani are brought in, because they're afraid of the type of culture, and it's, you know, skin color is secondary in this case.
Definitely.
Another thing that I try to explain is, for instance, in Switzerland is extremely nationalist. Okay, like extremely nationalistic. And I have a mutual on TikTok. She is German Armenian, but she studies Swiss history. She's a Swiss historian, right? And in her TikTok, she often says Switzerland is racist as fuck. And I mean, fact, but more than that, it's nationalistic. And she had to convene with me. We were tagging each other's videos by people trying to put us up against each other. But instead, we became great friends because we convened. That more than anything, the Swiss are nationalistic, because a Black Swiss citizen will always be better treated than a white Polish citizen. Always. You know?
Yeah.
Brexit came about because of the Eastern European immigrants, not because of their Black and Indian citizens. You know? So, I mean, and this is something that the US doesn't understand, that in certain countries, racism is directly correlated with the fear of different cultures.
In most of the regions of the world, that's the case. That's the case.
Exactly.
I'm thinking, like, for example, China and the Xinjiang region. That's another brilliant case. These guys are just Muslim. That's it. They look the same as the Wuhan.
Pakistan and India.
It's not about how you look like most of the time in most regions of the world. But you know, also this narrative of US has a bad impact. I live in Ireland, right? This country has been colonized by the English for hundreds of years. Actually, I think 1,000, because I think it started around the 12th century. Mm-hmm. So they've been colonized by them. They have a bad history with the famine in the middle. Like, so they're not the, let's say, the narrative of white supremacists, the white against blacks, the American narrative of it. It's wrong to apply in Ireland, as is wrong to apply. It's wrong to apply with me as well. Not because I don't want to be the white supremacist, because Calabria has been colonized since the Greeks until 1861. And 1861, we weren't free. The North conquered the South. I don't care the narrative you want to say. Garibaldi came and conquered us. That's it. That was the story. It wasn't a peaceful unification.
They made it nice and pretty, like, well, we all united.
Oh, unification. We didn't shake hands in Rome and be like, yeah, that's cool. No, they came, they conquered, they did all the things that conquering involves, killing and all that, torturing. So until yesterday, my region was always under the control of somebody else. I don't buy your narrative. I'm not the bad guy. Historically, my region or my country did back and forth, strive for surviving. Sometimes we conquer some others. Sometimes somebody else conquered us. It's not bad and good. It's not black and white.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
So if I apply that to me or to the Irish,
I came to Dublin last year in November, right? And I got on a taxi. My taxi driver was Nigerian and has been a naturalized Irish citizen for a while. I love talking to the taxi drivers in countries because they tell you so many interesting things because they know the place very well and they meet so many different people. So it's fantastic.
Definitely, definitely.
And he was telling me that while he grew up in Ireland, I was noticing that the signs were finally in two languages because they were in Irish, English, right? And I said, this is fantastic, but all the signs are new. What's happening? And he told me, this is something new because there has been such a linguistic erasure from the British into Ireland that now finally his children get to learn Irish in school. Something that his generation didn't get to do, but the new generation, yes, because they are reclaiming
their history,
culture that was taken from them, from the British. And so this is 1,000% a victim type of situation. And you can't say no because you're white. They haven't.
Yeah, also, but that idea of the white guilt is starting to apply here. I see my white Irish friends, they have white guilt.
I wonder why. Like, for what reason? Because as they were colonized.
They watch too many American podcasts. That's what is happening.
That's the problem, that if in the US they don't understand that the worldview that they have is exclusive to them. I'm not saying it's not universal. No, it's exclusive to them. And they don't start trying to understand that elsewhere it's different. They are going to apply that logic elsewhere. Now, as I was saying, since the nature of the racism is different, it's clear that in the US, you want to try and start fixing racism. Good. You need to pay... It's not retribution. What's the word? Reparations. You need to start paying reparations because you have deprived people of their history of money, blah, blah, blah.
You're okay with the concept of reparation?
In the US, yes.
Financial reparation.
Yes. You know why?
Okay. So the white of today is supposed to pay for...
Let me explain to you why. Let me explain to you why. And okay, look, wait. Let me explain to you why. So it's not a matter of the white of today needs to repay for the damage that has been done by people that they don't even know because they're dead, right? The reason why, for example, African-American U.S. citizens underperform consistently in school, it's because of a socioeconomic, like, vicious cycle that happens that destabilizes them economically consistently. So the fact that they have no, like, truly well done welfare system, like we have, for instance, in Europe, makes it so it's more difficult for them to go and vote. They consistently make it more difficult for them to have a good educational system, because there the good educational systems are private schools, which they cannot afford. And therefore, not having that, they're not able to sustain a job, not able to sustain a job, you can't do it. And so it's a vicious cycle. So they're starting to do this by having, I'm like theoretically against it, but I understand it's a necessary passage that you need by having like the quotas right now in universities for the scholarships to be like, okay, we need and Black students and whatever students, because the system is made so that they start with a handicap. So if they actually made up a system where they did equity. So I think that the easiest solution right now would be to make good public education and have it free. Because the level of...
They're supposed to be a little bit more European, let's say.
Exactly. In that, they're supposed to be a little bit more European. Because in Europe, in fact, private schools are pay-to-win type of situation, right? You graduate more or less regardless because you pay, blah, blah, blah. In the US, you only get access to good education if you pay for it, which is inhumane because actually it's made so that you keep your masses ignorant.
Yeah, it's definitely unfair.
It's on purpose and it's unfair. So once you have this type of system, of course, you're consistently... making it more difficult for certain demographics to go through. So if we want to avoid a situation where you actually have to pay physical money reparations, just like the Germans are still doing to Jews, right? I don't know if you know this, the Germans are paying.
No, you're shocking families. Me with this. Really?
Yes.
That's why, I mean.
The Germans are paying Jewish
families. I understand the situation as well, but that in my mind, the idea that you're paying some ancestor, like, where's my money from?
Well, they took all
where's my money from the Turks? Like, the Turks conquered us for 500 years. Like, I need to knock to some Turkish door now.
I know. But yeah, that is, so if you take they've taken their belongings, their homes, or whatever. And so the government, the same way in which, so here's the thing, you shouldn't be, if a person that has been consistently homeless because the government took their house, and then finally that homeless person gets a job and buys their own house again. If the government told them, well, we are not going to buy you a house, we're going to buy it for the other homeless person because now you have it, so there's no reason why I should give it to you. Even though the new homeless person got there on their own, and instead the other person had their house previously removed from the government. That would be penalizing you for doing well, regardless of your ill circumstances, right? So
I get it, but if you gotta apply that logic,
and again, if you look at the way in which the social system works for IMPS, for the retirement funds, the new generation that isn't even born yet is gonna be the ones paying for us. Where's their fault in that? You know, so it's a matter of the way in which countries work, the economic system in countries work. So it's not.
The thing I'm saying is how long back. All back in time, you're going to look for reparation, because I'm telling you, if we got to apply that in Europe.
Yes. So the idea, the concept is how much is today's generation still feeling the effects of it? And their today's generation, since there was segregation up until like the 50s, the 60s, it's very recent.
Okay, no, again, for that demographic, I can understand that. But
for that demographic, I think.
But
it makes
don't
sense.
You think the economic economic consequences of the unification of Italy, let's say, for us, mm-hmm. I told you we're the poorest region in Italy. Our people go abroad. I'm in Dublin. I can't live in Calabria. It's not suitable to live there and make a living there, right? So. Don't you think that's a case where you could apply the same logic? But if you apply with me, you need to apply to the Sicilians, to the Puglian, to the, you know, I'll say we is very difficult to draw lines here and say
again,
that's
we
yes, that's no.
We cannot do the same mistake los gringos are doing towards us. Like, we cannot apply their logic to Italy the same way in which they cannot apply their logic to, like, you can't do the same thing. We cannot apply our logic to them and they cannot apply their logic to us, because the reasons why we got to this point are different, right? So the way in which you cure the racism in the US is, again, addressing the fact that it creates inequality today. So you need to address the inequality today that was created by the fact that they have chosen to bring in slaves, by the fact that they have chosen to create segregation and all the implications that come from it, right? In our case, so in the Italian case, instead, the racism is created by the fear of this demographic who willingly gets into the country. And so instead, it's fixed by actually educating Italians on these newcomers and on the fact that they do not want to eradicate Italian culture or impose on it. They just want to live their life. So it's a matter of education here of the governing class. You see what I mean? And the type of education that we mean is not an academic type like in the US. It is like an understanding the situation type of education. On top of it, I think that if in Lampedusa, the government, well, the Italian government doesn't have the money for this type of thing, but if they set up like system where you could like teach the language and divide the immigrants in such a way where they can do the type of job that they were doing in their own country, you know, because some of them
that's that's very utopian, but
some of them degrees and stuff, you know.
Yeah, I can underline that. I work with them. I can tell you some of them they have degrees. They used to be doctors in their countries or lawyers.
So the only gap is simply the linguistic one. And if you can do like a service where you maybe pay back later once you have the job or whatever, where you teach the language as a government and where you can actually like classify those demographics into what their professions are, you have a much easier time integrating them and not having this, you know, this clash. Because, you know, the racist Italian will say, well, they bring criminality. Why do people don't just wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to be an asshole today and steal from people. No, people get their way out of desperation and they become desperate in a new country because they're not being integrated by the country. So
yeah. My argument before was not concerning our Europeans, migrants from sub-Saharan Africa. Was to how many group of people can we apply this logic? Because, you know, Kant used to say if something can be a universal law, therefore it's good, it's morally correct. That's the Kantian way of thinking. Kantian way of thinking. So if we apply the logic of reparation to US, can that be applied to other groups of people? Yes
no,
or no?
I think that the only place that comes close to there is South Africa.
Okay, close. With apartheid.
And it's not even the same thing.
Because so you think that is a unique case? You say USA is a unique environment?
Yes, I think the USA is a very unique case.
So not even, for example, the black Brazilians or
No. The situation with the favelas, it's much more of an economic type of situation. And it's not the same thing. It's truly not the same thing. Because they have community in a way which doesn't exist in the US. And there the problem is that there is no middle class. And I saw this in Panama as well. The fact that there are countries where no middle class exists makes it impossible to raise your economic standing and therefore your social standing in certain societies.
Okay, that sounds amazing. I see we have very little time left. So I think we can wrap it up here. Listen, so that was a beautiful conversation. I honestly had like 300 more arguments and topics to talk about. But
in a couple of months.
Yeah, we can do that again. Or if you want, we can organize something maybe on Twitch. Or
okay.
We'll see.
I'd love to double Twitch with you guys.
No, definitely. That will be amazing. Anyway, it was very nice. We can do that again some more time. And that was it. That's our so basically in our podcast, the way we end up the podcast is we say hello from whatever you are now to the place where your earth is. So I say bye from Dublin for Placanica, which is my hometown. For you will be treated.
Bye from Switzerland, from Panama, Tuscany in general.
Everywhere.
Tokyo.
I knew that would be our, that is the way of doing. Anyway, thank you.
Grazie Simone, ciao.